How's it going, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of The Sean and Matt Show. My name is Matt, that is Sean, and welcome to our show. Sean, in today's episode, we're going to be talking about a neighborhood, a subdivision in Arizona that has completely banned cars, automobiles, outright. No cars allowed in this subdivision. If you live in this subdivision, there will be 0 4-wheeled vehicles. Second topic of the day is an HOA is trying to ban institutional buyers, ban investors from purchasing inside of their community. Mm-hmm. And then our third topic got into a little bit of a Twitter flame war with another, I don't want to call him a real estate investor, with another Twitter user about an interesting take that this person had on how to buy a house in a competitive market. Multiple offer scenario, how to win as a buyer. This person laid out their plan, and it was an absolute horrible, horrific idea.
You tore them up.
We'll get into that and see if it really was as bad as I thought it was, because I could not do anything else because someone was wrong on the internet. And,
and
I
you had to fix that wrong.
Fix that. I can't.
And that can take a long time.
I just can't go living my life if I know someone is wrong on the internet. All right, let's get into the first topic. This comes to us from ABC 15 in Arizona. Cul-de-sac Tempe. Here's what a Tempe no car neighborhood could look like, Sean. This comes to us from Tempe, Arizona. Imagine a 17-acre plot of land completely torn to the ground, and there will be hundreds of millions of dollars put into this development where they're going to build hundreds of apartments where people can live in. They can walk to little dining options, little coffee stores, things like that. They can do everything that you can do at any other subdivision, except for there is one catch. There is no parking for any of the properties. And not only that, there is a clause in the lease that says you are not allowed to have a car. You can't even park a car on a surrounding street. So, Sean, what are your thoughts on this no car neighborhood?
Man, I don't know anything about Tempe, Arizona. I've never been there, so I can't say what the proximity is. But I hope that these people did their market research, because you're going after a very small segment of the population that really doesn't want to own a car. Now, you know, the younger generation, I think they are kind of more free-minded, and they kind of don't want to have cars, or they're that kind of people. But man, you're going after a small segment. And anytime that you narrow that segment, it's going to take longer to lease out. And will this last, right? So yeah, it's cool. It's a great idea. Hey, we're gonna be able to walk to everything. We can have little scooters that we can drive. We can have rental cars or lifts that'll pick you up. But what if, right? What if you wanna kind of live outside of that area? You wanna go to see somebody and you want a car. I think what's gonna happen is those surrounding neighborhoods that they say you're not allowed to park in, they're gonna see an uprise of parking vehicles in the future. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. And how are you going to ban that? I don't know. You know, in a lot of areas like my neighborhood, you have to get a permit. But you know what happens in my neighborhood? Here's one thing I'll kind of equate this to. I live pretty close to the hospital, and my street is the only one where you don't need permit parking, right? So I'll have, at the very end of my street, you'll see 5 cars every day. They never move. They sit there for a long time, or else you'll see people like eating their lunch in there or just hanging out in their car. And it's because they're allowed to park there because they don't need a permit. And so it kind of drives me crazy. And that's what I think is going to happen to the surrounding neighborhoods of this. Because let's face it, it's going to be cool. And a lot of people might find that cool. But you're like I said, you're really narrowing that segment of the population. Not only that, you're narrowing how you can turn it over, how quickly when something goes vacant, how quickly are you going to get another renter in there? So I think it's a cool idea, but a bad business proposition.
So a few statistics on the community: 761 apartments, 16,000 square feet of retail, and let's see, 1,000 residents. So mixed between, I think, studios, ones and twos possibly.
Now, where this could work, I was just thinking, they said, I think it's pretty close to a university.
Yeah, ASU is right nearby. So they could be using it
as student housing, right?
And looks like a dorm extension.
Right. So like when I went to college, my first 2 years, I didn't have a car. And then my last two, I would say I had a car that barely ran. But I mean, you know, if it's that student population they're going after, then that could be a good segment of the population that you're.
So New York Times did a piece on it a while back, and the construction is still going on, $170 million development. So this is in Phoenix, right?
Yeah.
Not the most walkable community in the world. Phoenix, I'm reading from the New York Times article, Phoenix has been called the world's least sustainable city, a sprawling urbanite wasteland, a monument to man's arrogance, and The Onion darkly predicted that by 2050, most of Earth's landmass will be swallowed by the encroaching Phoenix exurbs.
Oh my God. So just these sprawling neighborhoods.
But that's the thing. It's like when we think of car-free or car-friendly or zero-car diet neighborhoods, what do we think of? We think of city. We think of walkability. We think of like metro accessible and public transportation. We don't think of the desert. We don't think of, you know, a city that may have one of the second worst walk scores in America. So if this company can successfully create this almost utopian style of living, of building from nothing into this car-free community, that could be a game changer for other locations, whether it's in the middle of a city or, you know, middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, good for them for trying to create something that's unique and fun and different. Again, I've never been to this area, but it says that it's close to light rail, which it has to be, right? So, I mean, so they can get around through that. They have scooter things set up. They do have, they said 150 parking spaces around the community for visitors only. So if somebody wants to come visit you, that's the way you can park. But you cannot own a car. You cannot put your cars in those spaces. What I could see happening is, hey, the local storage places that have like the rent a garage kind of thing could start happening close to those light rails. But I think it's a cool idea. It's a cool concept. A little maybe before its time and maybe in the wrong area, but I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing at this point. But
I'm very curious to see what happens. It's supposed to open sometime this year, 2022. We'll see if that ends up happening, and maybe we'll check back in on it once it's all ramped up.
Yeah, because the thing that you always want to do is attract as many people as you can. You want that place to be full all the time, very low vacancy rates. So when you're segmenting yourself, it's a little tougher proposition, in my opinion.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right, our second article comes to us from marketplace.org. Homebuyer groups are trying to stop investors from buying homes. Sean, we've talked about the institutional investors that are coming in and just buying up houses and removing them from the housing inventory, making it extremely difficult for first-time homebuyers, move-up buyers, downsizers, upsizers, right-sizers to buy a house, to buy a home and to raise their family and to live comfortably. And this article details what some, they call them homeowner groups, what some HOAs have been doing to attempt to combat the problem, because the NAR released sales data that says that home prices fell, existing home prices fell, and not only that, the amount of individual investors who make up the cash sales is around 18 to 19%, which is up from 15% last year. So essentially, less homes selling, higher percentage of homes selling to institutional investors, institutional buyers. So what are some HOAs doing? They are attempting to change their covenants and making so there are additional rules, things of like that you have to live in the house for a period of time, call it 6 months or 12 months before renting the house out, or simply having some sort of lag period between purchasing the house and putting the property up on the rental market. Sean, what are your thoughts on HOAs trying to limit investor buyers?
My original thought is I like it. You know, there it's one thing to want to buy an investment property, which is nice for your family or whatever. You want maybe a second home or something like that. But this is institutional investors. These are investors that are gobbling up. They have millions or billions of dollars of money to buy these properties, and they're just buying and buying and buying, and they're making money off the rental, right? But you know, if I was living in an HOA and a community where it was a really nice community, and we didn't necessarily want everything bought up by institutional investors, and we wanted to live next to people that kind of were the same in the fact that they were buying their home and they had their own equity in that house and they had a reason to make it better and make it beautiful, that's kind of what you would want in an HOA, right? You would want your community and your neighborhood to stay healthy and to stay nice. And so I'm not saying that the institutional investors won't make it go down, but they're renting out to people. And there's a lot of renters that don't care for their homes. And I'm not saying this in a generalized standpoint. There are just people like this, right? And there's an example of this. I just renovated a place. It was destroyed by the renter. And if you look at people's yards and things like that, you want it to all be nice. And so when you get renters in there, some renters tend to not really care about that kind of thing, you know? And so I think it's good to a certain, good to a certain extent. And if you look at condos, right? Condos do this all the time. They regulate, a lot of them will regulate how many investors can actually purchase in that property. So there is some good to that. And I think it's probably good. I don't think I want institutional investors owning everything. I think, you know, having that free marketplace is good, but also having people that can live the American dream is more important.
Yeah. And especially in condos, you see that there are limits on short-term rentals. So, I mean, I probably get one email a quarter. Maybe you get the same of like, hey, can I Airbnb this condo? It's like, well, no, you can. You got to, you know, rent it out for a period of at least 6 months. You can't do these short-term rental bits. So there are in condo associations, but I would say condos are more stricter than HOAs when it comes to rentals. You know, the condo caps, the condo rules in terms of duration. But where does it end? Because the condos that do have the rental restrictions, that oftentimes gets in the way of sales prices and appreciation. And so if you have all these restrictions, hey, you got to be on a waiting list to rent it out, or hey, you got to, you know, jump through these hoops to rent out your condo, that is going to encourage people to sell their property instead of hold on to it. And it's also going to discourage normal, everyday retail buyers from purchasing in a condo or an HOA development rather than an HOA development that doesn't have these prohibiting rental rules.
Yeah, like we always say, and just like the last article, when you restrict the amount, the pool of buyers that can or want to buy in these areas, then you're restricting your increase in property values. So it can have a detrimental effect. And there is always, if you know, when we see a rise of a certain thing, right, when Airbnb got really big and it started exploding, Lake Barcroft actually had an Airbnb at the time, and they were using it for that. And the neighbors were just getting pissed because there was just constant parties. There was a pool and like just constant parties. And that's not why most people live there. They live there because that's their community. They want to live there full time. So that started the HOA saying, all right, well, let's restrict those kind of
buyers. So they changed the rules?
They changed the rules. So you could no longer do that. So that's the same thing with condos. So restricting institutional buyers, I don't think as a whole you should do it. I think maybe limiting it to, all right, this is how many institutional investors are allowed into it, like a 10% of the total community or something like that. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I think there are some communities that are being overrun by these institutional buyers. And we've seen and we've talked about in the past where there's these retirement funds that are just buying up whole communities, right? And so and that was from new developers and things like that. But I think it changes the dynamic of the neighborhood. And if you want it to change, that's one thing. If you don't, that's another thing. And so I think the HOAs have the right to say, hey, we like our community the way it is, and we don't want the institutional buyers here, so let's restrict.
Once you decide to live in an HOA or a condo association, you are giving up some of your rights. Now you're in a collective living space, and you know you have to abide by the rules and regulations, and every so often those rules end up changing. If they can change, if they can overcorrect, hopefully they can come back to center if something occurs that was maybe a mistake in hindsight.
Yeah, and that's always the problem with living in an HOA or condo. You have many voices that might be different from yours. And so when the rules are made or when the rules are voted on, you better be in there voting or else they're going to get changed and you're not going to like the outcome. And it could have a detrimental effect to a lot of things. Property values is the main thing. So you have to be careful. For the most part, HOAs are good in the fact that, you know, they stop you from doing certain things that could go could be ugly in the neighborhoods. But man, one of our biggest videos that we've talked about was just HOAs and how people hate them.
People want to sue HOAs every chance they get.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out where I draw the line on this. I think I am a fan of for new developments. If you buy in a new development, you are going to be living in that new development. Like, I don't think I'm on board with, hey, here's a new development, and then a bunch of people come buy it to rent it out. I'm thinking, if you buy it, you live in it for, I don't know, call it a year. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't want to have this laundry list of, like, you can only buy this property if, then, and because of these factors. I want to say, hey, listen, this is yours, live in it for a year and then do whatever you want in it, you know, inside the confines of the HOA rules. And if the board, you know, once they take over for a new development, HOA, the board wants to change the rules, so be it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good take.
Okay. Speaking of takes, a not so good take was on Twitter and I could not sit with it. So I had to respond. Sean, here is the take from @sweatystartup. I almost don't want to shout him out because I think he, from what I've been told, just posts a lot of hot takes and then just sits back and gets a lot of engagement from people that disagree with him. And to his credit, if you post something controversial, that's how things go viral because like people are just like, no, you're an idiot. And then it just it blows up. So here is the take on how to buy a house in a hot market. Fire your buyer's agent or don't have one. You're at a disadvantage in a multiple offer scenario. Work directly with the seller agent. Make an offer with a 2% credit to the seller and a 1% commission to the seller agent. Let's see. Don't do this if you don't know how to represent your own best interests, but if you know what you're doing, that's the best way to win the house because it can be 10 to 30K that isn't going to your agent. My friend has a property under contract in Georgia in this exact scenario. 4 offers, 370. Other offers had buyer's agents. You get the idea. And the seller's agent is making $14,800 versus $11,100 was huge. Capital, all caps.
Huge.
This individual is writing in all caps on Twitter. That's how you know this is a serious post. It's all caps and it's on Twitter. Okay, so the thread is a little bit longer, but I just want to break down a few misconceptions about this. The main points are this. Fire your buyer's agent. Use the money that would have gone to the buyer's agent as negotiating to make your offer higher and to give some more money back to the buyer's agent.
The listing agent.
Mm-hmm. That's essentially what it comes down to. Don't use an agent, and then the money that would have gone to the listing buyer's agent, give back to the seller and the listing agent. So, Sean, I replied. I couldn't sit with myself.
I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, and I sent
out
a message.
Represent those realtors, baby.
And the thing is, like, you don't necessarily have to use a buyer's agent. I wasn't upset. I shouldn't even say upset. I wasn't triggered. I wasn't triggered because he said don't use a buyer's agent. I was triggered because of the whole strategy was flawed from its inception, from its conception, if you will. So essentially, what he's saying is, hey, your buyer's agent is going to make 3% of this transaction, and instead of using the buyer's agent, use that 3% to differentiate your offer. First of all, That's factually incorrect. So Redfin put out a study in 2022, the same year that we're in, 3 months ago they put out a study, said the average buyer's agent commission is 2.6%. So he's saying, hey, your buyer's agent's getting 3%. Give back 3%. In reality, average in the United States, 2.6. So that's wrong. That's the first thing that's wrong. Second thing that's wrong is he's saying, like, do it all yourself. You have a multiple offer scenario. You could be going against 5 to 10 offers. I mean, how many times as you as a buyer have negotiated against 5 to 10 other offers in a real estate contract? Maybe you've done things at your own job or at a previous job, but negotiating a multiple offer scenario, asking the right questions, getting on the same terms with the listing agent and the seller themselves, that's a very difficult conversation and very, you have to do that very tactfully, because it's so easy to say, hey, just save the money and do it yourself. But there's so much that goes on underneath the surface that if you just try to do it yourself, what you're trying to do is negotiate against the agent whose job is to get the highest amount of money for the seller. You're basically trying to negotiate against yourself with someone that's done this a million times. So it's a very difficult task to do. And when it all comes down to it, this guy is saying that delta, that 2% that you're giving back to the seller and the 1% you're giving back to the agent. Oh, the agent is going to love that extra 1%. It's like 14,000 versus 11,000. Like
$3,000.
Who cares? And if you interviewed any real estate agent, I guarantee, would you rather have $14,000 and work with an unrepresented buyer who's trying to do it all themselves, which essentially means you have to do twice the amount of work and they're going to be making mistakes throughout the whole transaction? Or would you rather make $11,000 or $12,000 working with an agent that actually knows what they're doing and is a professional? The answer to me is obvious. And finally, and I know I've been talking for a while.
Go for it.
Is the delta, that 2% between your offer and the other competing offers, is not that much. Like the example he used was like a $370,000 house in Georgia, and you know the other people had buyer's agents and they ended up winning. But you know, in our market of the Washington D.C. Northern Virginia area, I mean we're going $100,000 over, $200,000, sometimes $300,000 over. So you know, who cares if you're trying to save like $10,000 when your offer is like $70,000 lower than the next highest offer. Yeah. Sean, I just looked at a property today and I wanted to see what it closed at. It closed for $97,000 over the asking price. Wow. And you as a buyer, if you're trying to do this yourself, again, I don't want to like have all this like realtor propaganda, but like if you as a buyer are trying to do it yourself, like how are you going to know that this property is going to close $97,000 above? Like, agents aren't just going to go around telling buyers what to bid so they can get an extra $2,500 in commission. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. And you know, the whole concept of this comes from somebody that's either starting up their own, you know, business, trying to butt into the realtors' businesses, right? And we've seen these types of people throughout my 20 years of doing this. There's always going to be somebody that says, oh, let's go after the real estate commission. Well, I'm telling you, man, like try our job and you'll realize that it's not all that it seems to be. And we work our butts off for not only representing our clients, but knowing the market and knowing what values are doing. Also learning how to write contracts so that we can win. And getting different techniques, going to seminars, which Lindsay's at right now, at a seminar, learning how from other agents on how to win, how to beat other agents, other buyers. And so if you're a lonely buyer out there that fires your buyer's agent or is doing it by yourself, you're screwed. I mean, because you're going after professionals. Think about like, hey, I'm a hockey player and I play in the high school league, but I'm going to go play against Wayne Gretzky and, you know, you're going to be outplayed, dude, every single time. And so you might bid on 100 houses and you might get one, but you're probably bidding on the one that's overpriced and you don't really know. So, I mean, you know, when you start saying things like this to real estate agents, yeah, naturally it's going to piss us off. But there's reality behind this. And, you know, we don't do this just to make money. We do this as professionals in this industry. And we're constantly watching and learning and figuring out for our buyers, representing them to the best of our ability to try to get them the deal. $3,000 doesn't mean anything to us when it comes down to it.
The thing is, I am fully aware that this strategy can work. Yeah, it can work. It can definitely work. There are people out there that are going to use this strategy. They're going to work, and they are going to shout it from the rooftop and say, fire your buyer's agent and use that money to, you know, win your offer. However, in the market that we're in, which is an unheard of market, I mean, there were, what, three other offers on this property, so four offers total. I mean, we're going up against 10 offers, 20 offers. I was up against 26 offers earlier this spring. Now, the market may be shifting a tiny bit with rising interest rates, you know, above 5% and trending towards 6%, to be honest. But I go back to my one really good friend who, you know, I think we bid like 11 times on 11 different properties. You know, if he was going to do that himself, he would have to reach out to like 11 different agents and like try to start from scratch and try to build that rapport and try to understand everything that the seller wants. And sure, they would give it to him. But compared to like a seasoned real estate agent who may already have a connection with that agent, who may already know that agent, know that office, know agents in that office, and know that agent's personality, it's very difficult to start from scratch over and over and over again. Now, again, we're you know, working with like DIYers, people that are maybe a little more scrappy and have the time to sit on Twitter and to write these ridiculous takes all days. And this strategy could work in a slower market, but in a competitive market landscape when deadlines are everything, this is a very, very risky scenario. And if you're considering it, I mean, this is one of those things where if you're considering it, I hate to say it, but I would almost say try. Mm-hmm. Go for it. Yeah. See what happens. You know, sometimes the best way to learn is to do it. And you know, I don't want to say fail, but like if you're having second thoughts about it, I can talk to you about it. But ultimately, if you want to try it on your own, I would encourage you to do it. See what happens, and then, you know, check back in with me.
You said one really strong word in there, and it was risk. And what you're doing in this standpoint when you're going to the listing agent is you're putting more risk on them. Me as a listing agent, I don't do dual representation. And basically that's what you're either asking them to do dual representation, to disclose to you more than they're disclosing to other people. They're putting themselves at risk, or they're going to do ministerial acts for you. They're not going to represent you. They are going to write a contract for you. So you're putting that agent at risk from doing the wrong thing or misrepresenting themselves. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to lose their license. And usually people like this that are trying to do that are the litigious kind of people that are going to go after you. You know what I mean? Like, that's just that type of personality. You know, you right. do one thing wrong and they're coming after you.
Sean, have you had individual buyers send you like their own contract in multiple offer scenarios? Or the attorneys send you a contract?
Oh, yes.
And you're like, what am I looking at
it's
here?
It's the worst written contract.
And then in the other terms, it's like commission to go to so-and-so. And you're like, dude, the commission has already been agreed upon by the seller.
It's awful. I did get one, and it was written by a lawyer. And you would think that lawyers have a little better idea of what to do, but they're professionals in their profession. We're professionals in ours. And that offer was immensely horrible and had no place anywhere in the competition. And so that's what we're trying to say is, like, when you're in a competitive situation, number one, you're putting that person, that listing agent, at risk. But you're also putting yourself at risk. Why would you go to a listing agent that's trying to get the highest price for his buyer, for his seller, the best terms for his seller? He could have zero offers, but he's going to tell you, hey, all right, this buyer is coming after it hard. All right, you know what? This is how I need you to write it. If you really want to win this, give me that. Give me the commission back. Give them the commission, and then I want to write you here, right? Does he have to show you proof? No. Like, hey, he's doing his job representing the seller. He doesn't represent you, so he's going to take advantage of it. And that would be a good scenario of an agent that is trying to represent their seller and not representing you, right? I mean, so there are so many things that could go wrong with that. So be careful on that advice. Talk to real estate agents. We're not here to take your money or to put you in bad situations. We're here to educate you and get you into the property that you want.
I do enjoy the back and forth.
I love it.
I do like the hot takes because in every hot take, there's something true to it. So, definitely something. All right. Well, I think our main camera just shut off. So I think that is a good time to wrap things up. All right.
Good conversation, Maddie.
Definitely a good conversation. All right, guys, thank you so much for watching. Hit the thumbs up button if you haven't already. And until next time, we'll see you then.
Take care.